Now, could you ever imagine yourself submitting another person to torture, stripping them naked, nearly drowning them on a waterboard to get the information you need? What if they were suspected of doing something so truly horrendous and unfathomable to people in your community or people you care for? Would you feel differently about the use of torture? In fact, has our whole moral calculus surrounding torture changed since 9/11? Earlier this month, the Court of Appeals in the US threw out a lawsuit filed against the man who wrote the so-called torture memos. You might remember them. His name was John Yoo. Yoo is the former senior Department of Justice lawyer who in 2002 effectively authorised the harsh treatment of suspected terrorists. He gave it its legal imprimatur, if you like. The torture memos, just to remind you, posited that so-called enhanced interrogation techniques like waterboarding, like sleep deprivation, might be legally permissible, and among other abuses, it led to the infamous mistreatment of prisoners at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq by US military police personnel. So when details of the abuses at Abu Ghraib were revealed, were you horrified, were you shocked, or did you think of it more of as an aberration, a product of a particularly ugly war? And now that the details of torture has been outed in public to the extent that it has, have we become, we want to discuss today, more tolerant of its use in specific circumstances? What does all this mean for civil society? These are all questions at the heart of a discussion that's going to happen at the Sydney Writers' Festival tomorrow. And two speakers from that discussion join me now. Glenn Carl is a former CIA interrogator and the author of The Interrogator, a CIA agent's true story. Welcome to Australia, Glenn.
Thank you.
And Danny Sallemeyer is the Director of Torture Prevention and the Human Rights Programs at University of Sydney. Welcome, Danny.
Hi.
Glenn, I guess I'm not going to ask you about what is an extraordinary personal history, because my colleague Paul Barclay on Big Ideas is going to do all that with you on the network on Monday night. But let's just get a sense of your past. Back in 2002, you were involved in the interrogation of a man suspected of being al-Qaeda, weren't you?
I was. I was a career operations officer in the CIA. That means I was an officer who worked overseas with the job of convincing people to provide secrets to the United States. I wasn't an interrogator, and the CIA had none. But we captured, in this specific instance, actually kidnapped a man whom we thought was one of the top half dozen officers, you could say, in al-Qaeda. And then I was involved in his interrogation and was told that I should do whatever it took to get him to talk, which I instantaneously found an appalling bit of guidance.
What was that guidance, to do whatever it took? What did that involve?
Well, I was involved in the early days of interrogation for the CIA. This is 2002 and early 2003, and there were, at that time, no formal guidelines. So the guidance consisted of exhortations to be creative and pressure him. Pressure him. And it was left to the officer, to me in this instance, to decide what that meant. Progressively, the agency implemented a series of quite formal protocols that included waterboarding or throwing someone against the wall or depriving them of light or food, things like that. But when I started, we were left to our own devices.
So tell us what conclusion you reached about this particular suspect.
Well, the individual I was charged with interrogating was, as I say, considered by, after thousands of man hours of work by CIA colleagues, one of the top members of al-Qaeda. Mm. But I was the only one ever to literally sit 3 feet away from him and look in his eye 15 hours a day and talk to him all day. Mm. And I concluded progressively that we did not know what we were talking about and that he was fundamentally none of the things that we assessed him to be. He was not a member of al-Qaeda. He was not a senior member of al-Qaeda. He had not sworn bayat to bin Laden, which is a loyalty oath. He was not a jihadist. We got it all wrong.
If he had have been a member of al-Qaeda, would you have felt differently about the range of interrogation techniques?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. No.
Why?
No, from the first second that I was briefed on what I was being brought in to do, it was clear to me that I was presented with the ultimate crisis and substantial, important moment of my 20-year career at that time. And I thought quite explicitly the signal moment, important moment in the history of the CIA, because the CIA obeys the law. We do not break the law, and the law is clear, and so is the spirit of the law in the United States. Americans do not torture, and what I was being encouraged to do, to me, clearly evoked the word. So from the first second, I was acutely aware that this was wrong, and I wouldn't do it.
Let's look a little bit closely at these enhanced interrogation techniques, the acronym EIT. There's an acronym for everything, even the most brutal things, isn't there? Perhaps particularly for the most brutal things. Do you believe that these techniques were ever successful in getting information from terror suspects, or more successful than traditional coercive techniques?
Well, the answer to all of those questions is no. They are not, they do not, they were not. It was clear to me that they wouldn't be. The argument that the ends justify the means is spurious, is too soft a word. It's just wrong. And the practical, you can look at this from a number of ways. On the practical sense, does torture work? The answer is no. Why? If you are under duress, if you are in pain, you will say something to stop the pain. But the job of the interrogator is not only to extract noise or comments, but to extract meaningful information that is verifiable. The job of an intelligence officer always includes the obligation to assess the reliability of the information. Something provided under duress and pain is exponentially harder to assess. So simply from practical grounds, it makes no sense whatsoever. Then there's the legal and the moral grounds, and there's no reason to do it from any perspective.
So your argument is that it produces less intelligence, and the intelligence that it might produce is less reliable, but...
That's a fact.
Certainly people disagree with you. Some people say there are other facts that are contrary to that, I'm thinking of... Jose Rodriguez, who's the former chief of CIA's counterterrorism centre, I mean, one of your colleagues,
yes,
in effect.
Yes, I know Jose.
He's written a book, Hard Measures, How Aggressive CIA Actions After 9/11 Saved American Lives. So he really feels that they have been successful in, cultivating counterterrorism strategy, and they've prevented further terrorist
strikes.
Well,
origins are important. And who wrote the book? It was ghostwritten by a man named Mark Thiessen and a man named Bill Harlow. Mark Thiessen was the former speechwriter for who? Oh, Vice President Cheney, who designed and issued the orders established the protocols for enhanced interrogation, a.k.a. torture. It was Vice President Cheney's office. Who instructed Jonathan Yu in the Department of Justice to write the memo justifying the policies that he was ordering be done? Vice President Cheney. So the book written by Jose Rodriguez is actually written by Mark Thiessen, which is actually written by the neocons to justify their actions, none of which is true. All of the reports...
So you're not convinced by any of the evidence that he presents?
All of the reports provided, intelligence reports obtained through enhanced interrogation techniques during my tenure from 2003 to 2007, were formally recalled as unreliable. So it's simply wrong. It's a way to justify and rewrite history. It's not the truth.
Okay, Danny Salamaya from the University of Sydney. In 2002, when these torture memos were written by John Yoo, America felt under threat. 3,000 people had died in the 9/11 attacks. I mean, it was a time, understandably, that Americans felt that they needed to defend themselves, their country, and I guess it got to a point of by whatever means. Do you think we should look at those memos as a sort of testament of a particular time and place and circumstance?
Oh, I think that's exactly right. I mean, as Glenn was speaking, I was thinking in answer to the question, is torture or enhanced interrogation techniques effective? Well, they're not effective, as Glenn has said, in getting accurate information. What they are effective in is establishing a climate of extraordinary fear. So if you create a narrative that says that there are these people who are so different to us, so inhuman, that they need to be subjected to the most inhuman treatment, and that's the only thing that we can do to protect ourselves, then you do establish exactly that climate of fear. I was in New York on 9/11. I lived there. And I watched the most extraordinary denigration of public culture, where people began to speak about themselves and about other people in a way that was completely unrecognizable to me. And, I had one of my colleagues say to me, I'm Jewish, and say to me, when we were discussing the invasion of Iraq, wouldn't you have wanted the United States to invade Germany in 1933? And I said, once you go down that path, you've lost, right? Once you start to see the situation as this clear understanding of where evil lies and any means necessary, then you're already in a narrative.
Well, evil's a difficult word, isn't it? I mean, yeah. So you're not even saying, you're saying we shouldn't even tread down the path. Do you think there are any circumstances where enhanced interrogation techniques can be deployed?
No.
Morally, for a moral reason, a utilitarian reason, or otherwise?
No, I think for deontological, absolute moral reasons, no. And I think for utilitarian means to ends reasons, no. And one of the reasons that I think that is that the empirical evidence across history tells us that this notion that Alan Dershowitz from Harvard proposed, that we could have targeted, limited, enhanced interrogation or torture, never proves to be true. Once torture has a foot in the door, it welcomes in its foot soldiers. Torture spreads, the techniques become more serious, there are variations, they're taken over, they spread beyond the people who are authorised to use them.
That's interesting, because you've done some very interesting thinking and writing about how an incident of torture can kind of infect a culture, an organisational culture, but a wider culture, a political culture, a social culture. What's your thinking there?
Well, on various levels. I mean, what the evidence tells us is that once torture is sanctioned in an organisation, it has deleterious effects on the organisational culture. Glenn spoke about the techniques of interrogation. Once you allow people to torture or to use enhanced interrogation techniques, it has deprofessionalising effects. It creates moral disorder within the organisation. You see this in the case of Greece, in the case of Brazil, where the military basically became a law unto itself because enhanced torture was permitted. In terms of the undermining of the rule of law and the basic principles that underpin any liberal democracy, I think it's really critical to understand that the norm against torture just isn't one norm against others. Amongst others. It's the basic norm that underpins a liberal democracy, that we have equal respect for all persons and that all people have integrity and they're not to be treated as means to ends. So once we start to let go of that, we're not just doing something particularly heinous to one or two or 10 or 100 people, we're undermining the moral fabric that allows us to act as and to perpetuate liberal democracy.
Yes, and I wonder what the public discussion about torture, and there has been a much more heightened conversation, since Abu Ghraib, since those torture memos. It's kind of, the word has lost its edge, hasn't it? Glenn Cull, I think you'd like to pick up on something.
Danny's speaking about something that is the most important point for all of us to grasp. I started, when my involvement began in the interrogation of this individual, I was immediately concerned about the issue of torture being done by American officials. That's a big deal. Then I realized, no, that's not the worst. Our laws are being broken. And then I realized, no, that's not the worst. Our system of checks and balances, our process of government, the institutions that we believe are honorable and protect us are being undermined. And then I realized that that's not the worst, that the public political culture in all of American society has been coarsened as a result of this. Responsible polling shows that if you ask Americans 35 and above, should CIA officers torture protect us? A strong majority say, absolutely not. That's not American. Mm. If you ask Americans 35 and below the same question, a majority of them respond, well, guys like Carl, CIA officers, it's okay. They
so
have
what's
to
happening
do what
there? Has there
do.
Been a generational shift and a sort of a shift in our relationship to torture? Just generally,
absolutely.
Because of the increased
absolutely.
Kind of public presence of it.
There are two specific causes for this. One, the Bush administration that spent 8 years justifying the strong measures it would take to guarantee national security, and the average citizen listens to his leaders and thinks, well, they must know what they're talking about. Their mandate is to protect us. And then two, I indict a television program I refuse to watch called 24, which is about a supposed CIA officer who spends all his day torturing people to protect them. And young Americans see this as part of the zeitgeist. It's okay. We can discuss it. And now one of the two major parties in the United States advocates the use of what is torture.
Well, it's now discussable. You refuse to watch the show, but the cat's out of the bag.
I refuse to
Millions
watch it.
Millions do. Yeah. Millions do.
It's awful.
Danny Salomo, you want to pick up on something?
Yeah, I was just going to, a little anecdote. I gave a lecture to first year sociology students, I think about 5 years ago, on torture. And I was showing some particularly graphic images, and I looked up, and at the back of the lecture theatre, there were kids on their mobile phones. And afterwards, I said to some of my students who were there. How is that possible? How is it possible to be in the presence of that narrative and those images?
Yeah.
And they said, oh, well, 24. I, of course, being an ignoramus, had never heard of 24, and I asked them what it was. And I think what Glenn's pointing to is this normalization of practices and also a distancing effect that you get through the narratives of fictional television like that, where the narrative trope is there's this really evil person who has a particular piece of information that is going to save a large number of very innocent people, and if we torture them, then we're going to get the information. That narrative in no way conforms with reality. There is never a case where there is one person and we know they have the information and we can torture them and then we'll get the information. But that narrative starts to construct the reality of young people who are exposed to that rather than being exposed to the sort of realistic narrative of who are the people are tortured, what are the information that we get, what are the consequences of that information. That's not what they're exposed to. And so you get a completely different, a different public understanding, not only of the consequences of torture, but also of the reality, the human reality of the impact that it has.
Yes, it strikes me as a science journalist too, I'm always interested in evidence and how you collect it. Very difficult to collect good, testable, you know, evidence for how torture works. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National, and my guests today are Glenn Carl. He's a former CIA interrogator. He's the author of The Interrogator, a CIA agent's true story, and Danny Salamire, director of torture prevention and the torture prevention and human rights program at the University of Sydney. Glenn, let's bring this back to the personal domain. Do we understand what impact torture and torturing another has on an individual interrogator and their well-being?
I'm not sure how to answer that. It was a profoundly disturbing experience for me. It was clearly the most important operation or professional challenge I had in my 23-year career, and moved me so powerfully that I felt obliged to write my book, because if I were silent, I would then tacitly be sanctioning practices that I find undermine the meaning of my government and society. So in that sense, it was profoundly disturbing. On the personal psychological level, I generally surprise people, I think, by saying that I feel, frankly, good about the role that I played. I think I fought the good fight and tried to do the right thing consistently. It's true that I failed in almost everything I attempted to do. But I personally don't feel traumatized from what I was involved in, but I refused to do anything. I would not do any of these things. Other officers who did these things, I know that they were troubled from the outset about the practices that they were being ordered to do and were becoming involved in, the psychological effects on them. I know of some officers who have been scarred or affected by this, but I don't have firsthand knowledge or close association with them.
Glenn, the torture memos were repudiated by President Obama in 2009. So enhanced interrogation techniques are no longer permitted, legally permitted. So in your view, is this a chapter in American history that's now closed, won't be repeated? What's your thought there?
Well, I'm afraid that it's not closed and that it may be repeated. And those are other reasons why I wrote my book. As I mentioned a moment ago, literally, and this is to me just flabbergasting, it's beyond imagination, but it is a fact that every presidential candidate for one of the two major parties in the United States has spoken formally in support of and advocates the use of, quote, enhanced interrogation techniques. This is unbelievable. So it hasn't gone away at all.
Danny Salamire, a final question to you. How do you think we can build, you talk about democracy being compromised profoundly, subtly and less subtly, because of this public conversation about torture. How do we inoculate democracy, in a sense?
Oh, that's a huge question. Where do I start? I mean, I think that the loss of a liberal arts critical education is really, I mean, that's going to a very structural level, but I think that's having a very long-term deleterious effect. That unless we educate people to be critical thinkers, that enables them to be active citizens, then democracy doesn't have a future. So it's not just about the institutions, about the rule of law. It's about enhancing the capacity of young people to become active critical citizens. And the more that we move towards an education system which is test-based, which is about pouring information into people's heads and asking them to replicate it, and the less we allow our young people to be imaginative critical thinkers, the more we're undermining that capacity for a future, a robust democracy.
A brief comment to you, Glenn.
This is a very interesting comment, and I agree entirely. To the extent one can create a profile of who a jihadist is, who a terrorist is, we find almost the only thing, there are a number of things, but the salient thing they have in common is a technical education in engineering or science or mathematics. None of them have the associative thinking that is derived or learned from a liberal arts
education. I think that's a stereotype, but anyway, as a humble engineer, I beg to differ.
Maybe you're a terrorist. I don't know. In the United States Naval Academy,
there's a moment in national radio.
has also assessed.
But
that,
I take your point. I mean, every good engineering degree should have a fully well and contextualized, rounded experience. You know,
it truly is a. It's not a cause, but it is a lack of this associative thinking that is inculcated from a liberal arts education is critical. The United States Naval Academy has found that the officers it's training, the naval officers for the United States, these are very impressive young men and women, lack often the ethical perspective or reflexive thinking that the United States wants. And they have concluded, the Academy, why? Because they have too heavily a science and engineering education and not enough of reading the great works.
Mm. Ethics in education. Mm. Let's perhaps advocate for that. Look, can I thank you both for joining us? I think this is a crucial discussion. Glenn Carl, a former CIA interrogator, thank you.
Thank you.
And Danny Salamaya from the University of Sydney, thank you.
Thanks
and
a lot.
Good luck with your session. They'll be speaking tomorrow at the Sydney Writers Festival from 2:30 p.m. to 3:30 p.m. So if you happen to be passing through Sydney in the east, do get along. And in fact, Radio National will be there broadcasting from 10 a.m. with Books and Arts Daily from the Sydney Writers Festival. As well, and right throughout the weekend. And also, Glenn will be talking on Monday night with my wonderful colleague Paul Barclay on Big Ideas about his memoir, so digging into his personal story much more closely. One not to miss. So that's at 8 p.m. on Monday and 7 p.m. in the West. Do tune in. Get on our Facebook page or our website and get talking about this issue. We'd love to read your comments. This is Radio National. This is Life Matters. Natasha Mitchell with you. We're heading to the South American jungle next.